What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Epochs. Hello and welcome back to Epochs. If you remember last time, or the last few times, we've been doing a mini-series where ultimately I want to talk about Constantine the First, Constantine the Great. But if you've been watching the other few episodes, you'll know that what I want to do is really, really set up that story. And in order to do that, talk about the generation before Constantine and the world in which he was born into and grew up in. So talking about his father, Constantius, and the entire Roman Empire and politics of that world, the world of the late 3rd century, the 200s BC, and the person that dominated it, the Roman Emperor, the most senior of many Roman emperors, was Diocletian. So we shall continue the story, leaving off a little roughly where we were last time. I'm going to miss out a little bit from Gibbon, reading from Edward Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. A masterwork, in my opinion, in a lot of people's opinions. Some people don't like Gibbon. They think maybe it's a bit old-fashioned, and I suppose it is quite antiquated diction. You know, the words he uses are quite old-fashioned, but I love that. I hope you guys are liking it. So talking about Diocletian and the rule of the four emperors, you remember the tetrarchy. So there was two main emperors, Augustus, the Augusti, which was Diocletian and Maximian. But of the two, Diocletian is the more senior one. So even though there's four emperors, there is like the main, most important one, Diocletian, then his co-emperor, Maximian. And then there were two junior emperors, the Caesars, Galerius in the east, and Constantius, who's Constantine's father. And last episode, we talked all about the state of the empire and that the Roman world had been going through the so-called crisis of the 3rd century, just endless invasions from barbarian peoples all over the entire Roman world, all the way from Britain, all through the Danube, northern Germany, all through the Balkans and in the east, out in what is modern day Iraq and Syria and Armenia, in Egypt and North Africa, the whole thing. And an endless succession, near endless succession, of Roman emperors murdering each other and usurping each other, and generals having proclaimed emperor and usurpations and all sorts of things, as well as a financial crisis as well. Okay, but last time we left off, didn't we, where I told you about the various problems and issues that had been put down in Britain and in the Near East, and then in the Far East, the furthest eastern stretches of the Roman Empire, that war that Diocletian, or really Galerius, fought against the Persian king, Narses, and that the Romans won it, and that they came to a peace which lasted for a long time. It was a sort of a solid peace for quite a while. That was where we left off last time. So I'm going to skip a few pages from Gibbon, which aren't massively important, and carry on the narrative where I think it is important and gets good again. So reading from Edward Gibbon, writing in the very late 18th century, early 19th century, he wrote this, quote, "The arduous work of rescuing the distressed empire from tyrants and barbarians had now been completely achieved by a succession of Illyrian peasants." Illyria is what the Romans called the bit of land which we now call basically Albania, or a big bit of Croatia, you know, that part of the world above Greece, you know, like in the Balkans. That's Illyria. And a fair few of the emperors here, Diocletian, was Illyrian. A peasant is maybe a bit much, but not all that much. That is a fair thing to say. The empire had been secured. The crisis of the 3rd century, historians and scholars say, was kind of over at this point. And it had been secured by a succession of Illyrian peasants. As soon as Diocletian entered into the 20th year of his reign, he celebrated that memorable era as well as the success of his arms by the pomp of a Roman triumph. Now, quick thing to say about the Roman triumph, if you've watched epochs before or you know your Roman history, you know that triumphs are an extremely important thing. It's something like a parade, right? Do you remember America used to have ticker tape parades after World War II, or when the first Apollo astronauts come back, you'd have a ticker tape parade, something like that. But it's much, 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 much more than that. It's got political overtones, and it's basically the highest honor you could ever dream of. Being part of a ticker tape parade nowadays might be nice, mightn't it? It would be an ego boost, but it's no more than that, is it? Whereas this, it goes down in history, it goes down in the annals of Roman history for all time. Very, very few men got to celebrate a triumph. Well, we're now in the 3rd century AD, so it's very different to sort of the age of the Republic. In the age of the Republic, you know, in the age of Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, say, or Pompey, a triumph was more important than it is now at this point. It really was the pinnacle of your career. It was more important than becoming the consul or a proconsul, governor of a big chunk of the empire. It's much more important than that. It was the most prestigious thing. Families, aristocratic Roman families, would turn the world upside down so that one of their members might have a triumph. That's how important it was. Well, ever since the age of Augustus, triumphs had become something slightly different. They'd become something that only really the emperor ever celebrated. They wouldn't allow someone below them to have a triumph because then they might become overpowerful and get ambitious ideas above their station. And it'd become much more ceremonial and less like a real honor, and more like a ceremonial thing. So, and triumphs hadn't been given out all that much. Emperors for a while hadn't had the time and the energy and the money to throw themselves a triumph. But Diocletian did. He spent 20 years making the empire safe, bringing it away from the brink of complete collapse. And now, finally, he throws himself a Roman triumph. Gibbon goes on saying, Maximian, the equal partner of his power, although not truly, truly equal, but at least on paper supposed to be, the equal partner of his power, was his only companion in the glory of that day. The two Caesars, Constantius, Constantine's father, and Galerius, had fought and conquered, but the merit of the exploits was ascribed, according to the rigour of ancient maxims, to the auspicious influence of their fathers and emperors. The triumph of Diocletian and Maximian was less magnificent, perhaps, than those of Aurelian and Probus, but it was dignified by several circumstances of superior fame and good fortune. Africa and Britain, the Rhine, the Danube, and the Nile, furnished their respective trophies. But the most distinguished ornament was of a more singular nature, a Persian victory followed by an important conquest. The representations of rivers, mountains, and provinces were carried before the imperial car. The images of the captive wives, the sisters, and the children of the great king afforded a new and grateful spectacle to the vanity of the people. In the eyes of posterity, this triumph is remarkable by a distinction of a less honourable kind. It was the last that Rome ever beheld. Soon after this period, the emperors ceased to vanquish and Rome ceased to be the capital of the empire. End quote. Just to cut ahead, just to let you know what Gibbon's talking about there. After the reign of Constantine, broadly speaking, that's kind of the last golden age of Rome, ancient Rome in the West, certainly. And they suffer another long period of decline until the end of the Roman Empire in the West. And where Gibbon says Rome ceased to be the capital, yeah, it was because Rome keeps getting invaded by foreign tribesmen and barbarians all over the place. It was thought that Rome was a bit too indefensible and wasn't in the ideal place in order to defend Italy and defend sort of southern central Europe, and that a place called Ravenna was a better place to hold the capital. And so Rome still nominally was, you know, the mother city. That could never be taken away from it. But as for the seat of the emperors, it moved to Ravenna. But that's in generations to come. Okay, Gibbon continues saying, the spot on which Rome was founded had been consecrated by ancient ceremonies and imaginary miracles. The presence of some god or the memory of some hero seemed to animate every part of the city, and the empire of the world had been promised to the capital. That is one of the seven hills of Rome, where the seat of government was on, the Capitol Hill. The empire of the world seemed to be promised to Rome. The native Romans felt and confessed the power of this agreeable illusion. It was derived from their ancestors, had grown up with their earliest habits of life, and was protected in some measure by the opinion of political unity. The form and the seat of government were intimately blended together, nor was it esteemed possible to transport the one without destroying the other. But the sovereignty of the capital was gradually annihilated in the extent of conquest, i.e. the Roman Empire was too big to be ruled by one city, one city-state. That's the idea that Rome is a city-state. It just happens to control lots of land. Well, the empire was just too big and complicated for that anymore. Had been for a long time, centuries. Now, the Roman political system recognises that. It had been known for a while. But who was going to really, who even really had the power to profoundly change things enough to deal with it properly? Well, somebody like Diocletian thought he could, and or did. The provinces rose to the same level, and the vanquished nations acquired the name and privilege without imbibing the partial affections of Romans. What he's saying there is there were places in the empire that were as rich, if not richer, than Rome, as powerful in their region as Rome, and that the conquered peoples would call themselves Roman, consider themselves Roman, lived under some sort of Romano culture and were part of a shared economy and things, but they weren't truly Roman, you know? They didn't truly, truly, really, really care if Rome itself, the actual city of Rome, was destroyed or not. That's an important thing, isn't it? An important thing. Gibbon says, during a long period, however, the remains of the ancient constitution and the influence of custom preserved the dignity of Rome. I said that before. They've still got consuls and praetors and quaestors and tribunes and all that sort of thing. The ancient norms of government. But whether they'd all, you know, whether they had been either completely superseded by the imperial rule, they were just paper titles, or whether they actually functioned, it's somewhere between those two things. And it would depend exactly what period you're talking about, exactly which emperor you're talking about. Gibbon says, the emperors, though perhaps of African or Illyrian extraction, North African that would be, people of European, usually Italian descent that just happen to be in Africa, not actual sub-Saharan Africans, North Africans, whether they be of African or Illyrian extraction, respected their adopted country as the seat of their power and the centre of their extensive dominions. The emergencies of war very frequently required their presence on the frontiers, nearly all the time. No, during the crisis of the 3rd century anyway, nearly all the time. But Diocletian and Maximian were the first Roman princes who fixed, in time of peace, their ordinary residence in the provinces. I.e. they weren't stationed, they didn't live in Rome. They lived on the frontiers in various ways. And their conduct, however it might be suggested by private motives, was justified by very specious considerations of policy. I.e. they had to do that. They had to live on the frontiers and in the provinces. The empire just wasn't stable enough just to spend years on end sitting in your villa in Rome and let the armies and the governors get on with it. It was too fractured and unstable to do that. And as we said, one emperor isn't enough. You needed four. Well, that's what Diocletian. Gibbon says, the court of the emperor of the West was, for the most part, established at Milan, whose situation at the foot of the Alps appeared far more convenient than that of Rome for the important purpose of watching the motions of the barbarians of Germany. Milan soon assumed the splendour of an imperial city. The houses were described as numerous and well-built, the manners of the people as polished and liberal. A circus, a theatre, a mint, a palace, baths, which bore the name of their founder, Maximian. Porticoes adorned with statues and a double circumference of walls contributed to the beauty of the new capital, nor did it seem oppressed even by the proximity of Rome. To rival the majesty of Rome was the ambition likewise of Diocletian, who employed his leisure and the wealth of the East in the establishment of Nicomedia, a city placed on the verge of Europe and Asia, almost at an equal distance between the Danube and the Euphrates. By the taste of the monarch and at the expense of the people, Nicomedia acquired, in the space of a few years, a degree of magnificence which might appear to have required the labour of ages, and became inferior only to Rome, Alexandria, and Antioch in extent and populousness. The life of Diocletian and Maximian was a life of action, and a considerable portion of it was spent in camps, military camps, or in their long and frequent marches. But whenever the public business allowed them any relaxation, they seemed to have retired with pleasure to their favourite residences of Nicomedia and Milan. See, Rome itself isn't in the ideal spot, halfway down Italy. It's a bit out of the way. If you need to suddenly respond to a barbarian invasion, you're a bit too far away. The barbarians could make inroads and cause all sorts of havoc before you even get there. Till Diocletian, in the 20th year of his reign, established his Roman triumph, it is extremely doubtful whether he ever visited the ancient capital of the empire. Even on that memorable occasion, his triumph, his stay did not exceed 2 months. Disgusted with the licentious familiarity of the people, he quitted Rome with precipitation 13 days before it was expected that he should have appeared in the Senate, invested with the ensigns of the consular dignity. End quote. That says a lot, doesn't it? Diocletian may well never have even been to Rome. He was a Roman general, had been for years, had been the Roman emperor for 20 years, might not even have been to Rome. And then when he did finally feel like he, just to celebrate his triumph, he was supposed to stay there for a while so that he could go before the Roman Senate, which of course all still existed. Remember I'm saying, they still got consuls and elections for consuls and praetors and everything every single year, just as they always had, even though the whole thing's a bit hollow and kind of pointless. They still did it. And he was supposed to appear before the Senate where they could, you know, heap honours on him and proclaim him again as their emperor and just kiss his feet and suck up to him massively. He didn't even stick around for that. He didn't even bother to go through that. It meant nothing to him. It meant nothing. The importance of Rome itself, the city of Rome, had massively, massively declined. Gibbon goes on saying, the dislike expressed by Diocletian towards Rome and Roman freedom was not the effect of momentary caprice, but the result of the most artful policy. That crafty prince, Diocletian, had framed a new system of imperial government, which was afterwards completed by the family of Constantine. And as the image of the old constitution was religiously preserved in the Senate, he resolved to deprive that order of its small remains of power and consideration. Here we're talking about, do you remember in the first episode I talked about the Principate, Augustus's Principate and Diocletian's Dominate. Diocletian changes the game, where, if you remember, I said that the Roman emperor's word became absolute law. He didn't even have to pretend remotely to get anything rubber stamped by the Senate. Well, this is what's going on here. Gibbon continues saying, we may recollect about 8 years before the elevation of Diocletian, the transient greatness and the ambitious hopes of the Roman Senate. As long as that enthusiasm prevailed, many of the nobles in Rome imprudently displayed their zeal in the cause of freedom. There may have been rumblings that they wanted a republic back. And after the successors of Probus, a previous emperor, had withdrawn their countenance from the Republican Party, the senators were unable to disguise their impotent resentment. As the sovereign of Italy, Maximian was entrusted with the care of extinguishing this troublesome rather than dangerous spirit of republicanism among noble men in Rome. And the task was perfectly suited to his cruel temper. Remember, Maximian is a soldier's soldier. Anyone or anything gets in his way, he'll cut it down. Simple as, no second thoughts. That's who Maximian is. Diocletian gives him a job to do, whatever it is, however bloody it might be, and he will just go and do it. Gibbon says, the most illustrious members of the Senate, whom Diocletian always affected to esteem, were involved by his colleague in the accusation of imaginary plots, and the possession of an elegant villa or a well-cultivated estate was interpreted as a convincing evidence of guilt. We've seen this before, haven't we, in Roman history? As far back as Sulla and Marius, let alone all through the early Julio-Claudian emperors, that if you're too powerful, too rich, even remotely, you're a problem. The state, the imperial throne sees you as a problem. Again, 300 years more before this, 400 years, the enemies of Sulla would say things like, I've been murdered by my Alban estate. I just had a bit of money and power and influence, just a little bit. And that was enough to have you, all your property stolen and you murdered, maybe your whole family. That's playing out again here. Diocletian wants absolute power, completely unfettered. We hope you enjoyed that video. And if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the States in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.